Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we jump into today's interview, here's a reminder that you can subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube or to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights throughout the month. If you prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Today's interview features a leading figure in long COVID research, a still emerging field that is encumbered by established terminology and diagnostics as it is increasing patient cases. Dr. Julia Moore Vogel, the program director of the Participant Center at Scripps All of Us Research Program, joins to discuss the still evolving space of long COVID research, from pathophysiology to screening methodology, as well as her own early contributions to defining the disease and mitigating its impact. Before we get into today's topic of long COVID and the review article published earlier this year in Nature's Review Microbiology, can you please tell our listeners a bit about your background, the current role at the Scripps Institute? I know you're also involved in the All of Us research program and several other genomic projects. How did this lead to you and your colleagues completing such a comprehensive look at long COVID?
Sure. My career has been pretty nonlinear, so I'll tell you a little bit about it. I started with my PhD in computational biology, which at the time was kind of a new field, combining data analysis, math, and biology. And it gave me a really great foundation in how to analyze large-scale data sets. After that, I ended up going to get an MBA, and my idea was that I could work at the interface of science and business. So there's so much of science that's, you know, discovery, that's really important things that end up not getting translated to really help patients in the end. And so my idea was somehow maybe I could be at that interface and try to move discoveries along to be able to have wider application. So for the last 5 years, I've been working at Scripps Research, heading up our All of Us research program efforts, which is a program that is working to engage at least 1 million folks across the United States to share information about their health for a broad database that researchers really across the world can use to study all different diseases. So it's a disease agnostic cohort that is being used already by thousands of researchers in the United States, and we're working on international expansion as we go. So that was really the sort of the foundation that I was building on. And then in 2020, I contracted long COVID myself and really wanted to use those skills that I had to be able to contribute to this massive need for long COVID research. And so we're doing some of our own long COVID research that we can talk about a little bit more later, but we really saw a need for this comprehensive review because there's so much literature coming out. It's really hard for anyone to stay on top of. And so Eric Sopel and Hannah Davis, in particular, two of my co-authors on the review, are two of the people that are the most on top of the literature of anyone. And then Lisa McCorkle and I also came in to help with this review because it was such a massive undertaking. And the four of us worked together to put it together. And we've been really surprised by the reception. It was downloaded, I think, over 100,000 times in the first week, for example. It really shows the need for this resource and how everyone's having a hard time synthesizing all of the information about long COVID and keeping up with all of it, particularly the medical community, where, you know, things are changing so fast and they're patient-facing. It's very hard to keep up with all of that literature. And so we hope that it can help in a lot of different ways for both researchers who are getting into the field, the medical community, and the patients who are interested in what's happening as well.
No question, there's a need, and I only hope this podcast gets listened to 100,000 times, but
that'd be great.
It's great having you on. I think it's an important topic. Certainly, the Lung Association views it as such. So one of the issues surrounding long COVID has been the lack of consistent terminology, as well as the definition of what the condition actually looks like. Can you tell us where you think things stand at this point?
Yeah, this has been a major challenge. I think one of the biggest components that makes it so challenging is that long COVID can present in so many different ways. There are over 200 different symptoms that folks can have. And we don't even have well-defined, I think, yet, what the subtypes are. There are different ways that the symptoms can overlap. There are different severities. You know, some folks just feel a little bit less than how they used to be. And some folks are completely bedbound. And so there's this this wide variety of presentations makes it really hard to classify what it is. The other challenge is, you know, some folks want the definition to include that someone had a documented infection, like a PCR positive infection. But particularly early in the pandemic, it was very hard to access those tests. And now we're in the same situation where, you know, much of the testing infrastructure has gone away and people might not even realize that they had a COVID infection. And so that piece, that diagnostic piece has been a real challenge, both for folks who are trying to get care, but also for the clinical trials where it's like, you only want to do a trial on someone that you know had COVID, but you don't want to be excluding people that weren't able to access the testing when they needed it. So I think, you know, there's a lot of discussions going on, particularly the National Academies just had a really great discussion about the definition. And I think there's really good patient engagement to try to come to a definition. I think it's one of those things where we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Right. You know, listen to the patients and what they're telling you and, you know, learn about the disease in general, and you can make a best guess about what it is. You know, a lot of things in medicine aren't perfect, and I think that's the kind of situation we're in here.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on, I know that a recent scoring system to identify those with long COVID was developed by the NIH's Research in COVID to Enhance Recovery Program, or Recovery Initiative, and was published in JAMA recently. What do you think of that scoring system? Have you had a chance to review that?
Yes, I think that it's a good idea. I understand why people want to do it, right? Because we want to have, we don't have a biomarker right now, and we want something really quantitative that we can point to. One of the challenges of that type of research, you know, it's electronic health record based, is you only get what's captured in the record in a really concrete way. And my personal feeling on it is, it's not a very rich data source for the types of things that we're experiencing. You know, it's hard to classify something like debilitating fatigue, for example, in the medical record. It doesn't always get classified the way you might want, unless, you know, you're mining the notes, which is a totally different thing that I believe was not done in this study. And so I understand the temptation, and it makes sense to do that sort of literature. One of the challenges that came out with this was then people wanted to say, okay, then we're using this as a diagnostic. It's a cutoff. You're here. You have it. You're here. You don't. And that was sort of taking the results too far in our rush to be able to have a real cutoff. So that was one of my concerns about it. But I think this type of research, you know, mining the data that's out there, that's passively collected essentially through the electronic health record, is really important. One last piece I want to say about the challenges of that type of research is, you only get the folks that are interacting with the healthcare system. So you're losing, you know, those that have lost insurance coverage because they're unable to work and unable to access it through other ways. A lot of times you're losing the most severe cases because folks that are bedbound aren't accessing the healthcare system anymore because it's just too much for them to be able to do. They don't have the energy to be able to go out. And so, you know, that I worry a lot about both of those things, that you're missing pieces of the puzzle, and that we really have to be thoughtful in the research that we're designing to make sure that we're including those that need the need to benefit from the research the most.
Now, that's an important perspective that you have, because we know that COVID-19 shined a light on the disparities in the healthcare system, and we need to be aware of that throughout every way we look at this disease.
That's right.
Like other infections, an individual's response and ultimate outcome from the infection depends a lot on the interaction of that invading agent. So in this case, SARS-CoV-2, and the body's immune system. Can you give us a sense of our current understanding of how that interaction plays out and how it was determined, how the different systems of our body have been affected in this population with long COVID?
Yeah, I think it's really early days on our understanding. I just want to acknowledge that. You know, we have in the review a few different potential mechanisms and ideas about how the body is infected, affected by the infection. And so, you know, I think it's, there was also a really nice review that came out about the immune system in long COVID that I actually haven't had a chance to read yet, but it just came out this week. One of the theories that I have found really fascinating is about microclots and how, you know, there are these little tiny blood clots forming and how that can actually lead to something like mitochondrial dysfunction. And, you know, folks are starting to put the pieces together to understand what the cascade looks like, but I think it's still really early. On the immune system point in particular, there's evidence of autoimmunity in many folks with long COVID, but not in everyone. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it could be possible that there are different subtypes of what can be the root cause of long COVID symptoms. And we're actually putting it under one umbrella now because all that we know is that it's all caused by this COVID infection to start with. But I'm very interested to see how the research continues on the things like autoimmunity, like microclots, like mitochondrial dysfunction, to see if there's unifying theories in there, mm-hmm. or if we actually have distinct subtypes that we'll be able to treat differently eventually. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Another thing that feeds into this next question is, if there's different things that are going on, I know in your article, you had a special section on long COVID in children. Do mm-hmm. you think that's a different entity, or we still don't know a whole lot about that either?
I think we're, again, in the early days. You know, in the review, we were really just trying to bring the evidence forward that yes, long COVID does exist in children, because it has been, I mean, long COVID in general has been minimized. And that's one of my main concerns about where the field stands today in terms of people's understanding of the level of severity of disease and addressing it. Commensurate with that level of severity. But I think in children, it's been particularly dismissed. You know, it's harder sometimes to characterize something in a child when a child is saying they're really tired. Somehow it's different than an adult. And it can be difficult to spot. But I think that children have had even more dismissal of their symptoms than adults have. And that's saying a lot, because a lot of adults have had a lot of dismissal. But really, in the review, we were just trying to say, hey, there are some studies showing the prevalence of long COVID in children, and this is an area that needs more research. I don't think we understand really well whether and how the mechanisms might differ in children.
Do you think that the awareness of that among pediatricians is there, or do you think that's another point where we have to raise awareness?
I think awareness amongst the physician community at large could be improved, particularly pediatricians, for sure. But I think, you know, it's hard that something it's not brand new, because we've had myalgic encephalomyelitis for a long time, but the prevalence is so much higher now of these types of conditions, you know, like ME/CFS, like POTS, that were previously considered sort of rare and niche. Now the prevalence is right now 6% of US adults are estimated to have long COVID based on the CDC's Pulse survey. And so it's not rare at all. Every primary care physician, whether they're taking care of children and or adults, should know about this and be able to, you know, help folks, first of all, identify it in themselves, because a lot of people in the general public also are not aware of long COVID yet, despite this large prevalence. So identifying it is the first step, and then helping folks be able to access care and do their own work to be able to try to manage their symptoms is really important. And just on the symptom management point, you know, for myself and many others with long COVID, because we don't have good treatments yet, the best medicine for us is actually to rest. And so it is the most counterintuitive thing for me personally as a lifelong overachiever. It is so hard to view rest as medicine, but it absolutely is. So I'll tell you a little bit about the work that we're doing here at Scripps is about helping people figure out when they need to rest. And so what we call this concept in the community, and it's really inspired by the ME/CFS community, is pacing. So it's the idea that just like you would pace to run a marathon, you're not going to sprint the first mile. You have to pace just to get through your daily life. And so, you know, you're dealing with very severe energy limitations, and understanding how to pace and how to decide what things you can do in your daily life or not do is very difficult. I mean, we're talking basic things like, can I take a shower today or not? Do I have enough energy for that sort of activity of daily living? And so what many in the long COVID community have found helpful, myself included, is wrist-worn wearable devices. So I actually wear two myself, but the one that's been the most helpful is Garmin has this feature called Body Battery. And it takes into account your sleep, your heart rate, your stress levels, and your step count to make the score from 0 to 100, basically the same as your cell phone score, your cell phone battery, saying, okay, do you have energy or do you not? And so I'll tell you, today is a bad day for me. My battery's already at 15, which means I need to rest right after this. But that score changes throughout the day based on what you're doing. And that guides everything that I do to say, okay, I woke up this morning and I knew that I was going to need to take it easy today. If I woke up with 100, then I would know, okay, it's a good day for me to take a shower. And so we are doing a research study to distribute these devices and educational materials to participants to see if we can help them stay within their energy envelope. And what that means practically is, you can avoid exacerbating your symptoms. So there's this concept called post-exertional malaise, where if you go above your energy threshold, you worsen all your symptoms. And so for a lot of folks, that means they're completely bedbound. For me, it usually means I end up with a debilitating migraine that, you know, sometimes I can manage with medication to keep going throughout the day, but sometimes I just have to shut down and lay in the dark for hours on end. So if you can stay on the right side of your energy envelope, you can avoid making things worse, both in the short term for the symptoms that you have in the days following, but also there are theories and a lot of anecdotal data that you can avoid making your symptoms worse in the long term. That if you keep going above what your body can do, you're actually doing long-term damage and you're actually shrinking your energy envelope, which is this really cruel pathogenesis in my view, that it's like you're already feeling constrained, you go beyond your constraints, and then you're punished by your constraints getting even smaller. So that's one, you know, that's basically the best for many folks symptom management technique at this point. And we're really looking to help folks be able to implement that because it's very hard to do. It might sound simple, but
I'd say it's analogous to the real-time feedback is the important thing. Being able to
able to have hard data to validate what you're feeling is crucial.
Great. I think you also fed into my next question, which, you know, early on, many researchers were noting that the long COVID patient was similar to some other post-viral syndromes that we've seen before, like chronic fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalitis, and other dysautonomias and related conditions. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us if we have some differences or similarities exist with long COVID and these other entities?
Sure. So not everyone with long COVID has dysautonomia or ME/CFS, but many folks do. It's estimated that half, for example, have ME/CFS. So in my view, it's indistinguishable from the literature that I've read. Once you have the symptoms and meet those diagnostic criteria, it seems exactly the same. So, you know, that's why I'm so excited about pacing and other things that we've learned from the ME/CFS community are actually the best tools that we have today, even though those diseases have been relatively under-researched and dismissed. What they have done, those communities in the past, is the best thing that we have to act on.
As a pulmonologist, I kind of have a sense that there's a shift from long COVID mainly being manifested as persistent respiratory symptoms like cough and dyspnea. And now we're seeing things like you've mentioned, the fatigue, the cognitive issues or brain fog, some cardiac issues like POTS. They seem to be more persistent. And I know many clinics began multidisciplinary approaches to patients like this because of all the different systems involved, pulmonology, neurology, cardiology, endocrinology, and including psychology and psychiatrists, very important. Based on your work, are there some diagnostic tools available, aside from the all-important history and physical, to help to determine the presence of long COVID in certain individuals and how it's going to impact their treatment journey?
Yeah, there are tools to diagnose things like ME/CFS. There are clear diagnostic criteria for dysautonomia there. You can do tilt table tests and things like that to understand whether folks have it. I still think one of the best ways to understand the impact on the patient is to just ask about their activities of daily living. You know, some of us get so caught up in what we're doing that it's hard to remember how severely limited we are. So there are real surveys to assess that, but even just a conversation about, you know, how many times a week do you shower, or, you know, are you able to keep working, you know, the functional impact and the level of disability that you have are, to me, the most important things for a physician to know about to be able to help the person manage their symptoms. In addition to those diagnostic tests, like, for example, for dysautonomia, there are beta blockers and different things that you can try to help the patient manage their symptoms.
So you mentioned a lot about the feedback and knowing how to pace yourself. Is the treatment landscape changing much at all? And where do you see the research needs to be focused for this condition?
I have been very disappointed by the lack of sense of urgency to treat this condition. I think, you know, it's been very difficult because we all want the pandemic to be over and we want to just move on because it was a very difficult time at the beginning of the pandemic for everyone to be, you know, shutting a lot of things down and minimizing social interaction and that sort of thing. And we're all just so set on getting back to life as usual that, in my view, we have conflated that, the pandemic ending, with the long COVID mass disabling event ending. And very few long COVID patients are recovering. There was just a paper this week that said about 8% of folks recover in the first 2 years. So this is just, you know, as far as we know, a very long-term syndrome that we don't have good solutions for at all. And so in my mind, we should be focusing now on clinical trials. And there are many candidates, some of which we have in our review, but there are even more more resources that have come out since we published that review in January talking about what candidates we should be testing. There are just now starting to be some trials, which, you know, in my view is very late given that we're over 3 years into the pandemic, but there are, you know, a couple hundred now on clinicaltrials.gov. But most are very small sample size, you know, 100 at most. Mm-hmm. Some are 20 or 40. And so those are not going to be well-powered enough to really impact care on a large scale. And those results probably won't be in for a year or two. And so I remain concerned that we are not doing enough with the clinical trials to be able to treat people in the near term. I often say, since I first got long COVID, I've been saying, I think we're 5 years away from having good treatments. And I think we're probably still 5 years away from having solid treatments. The other challenge with the small sample sizes now is we talked about the subgroup effects, that I expect that there are going to be some things that work for some patients and some things that work for others. And so we need well-powered studies to be able to capture those differences and understand which symptom presentation can be addressed with which treatment.
So as COVID evolved, we saw different variants and then ultimately the institution of effective vaccines. Have you been able to determine any significant differences between the variants and which ones may predispose to developing long COVID? And have we seen benefit of the vaccines, for that matter, in preventing the development or the severity of long COVID?
The biggest change has been the vaccines, for sure, decreasing the prevalence of long COVID, which is wonderful to see. Unfortunately, the vaccines weren't available when I and many others contracted it. But, you know, it's an added benefit that when I'm talking to someone about getting vaccinated, I definitely mention that. We've also seen some trials, like the metformin trial, for example, reducing the risk of long COVID if you take it in the acute phase. And so I hope to see more things like that to be preventing long COVID in general. The difference between the variants is kind of difficult to ascertain because there are so many other things that we're conflating the data. So I don't see that as a huge effect in the past, but I don't rule out the possibility that we could have a variant in the future that changes the prevalence of long COVID for better or for worse.
I know we touched on this a little bit earlier, but like so many other things in healthcare, we did see disparities in the populations affected by COVID and now also by long COVID. And you mentioned some of the reasons why that's going to be difficult to study. Any other thoughts to explore in that area of disparities? Is it the social determinants of health that's the main thing? Is it the virus itself? What do you think?
Absolutely. We've seen, you know, larger prevalence of COVID cases in certain groups, like, for example, Black and Hispanic communities were struck more by COVID in the beginning. And so it's not surprising now that we're seeing a larger prevalence of long COVID in those communities as well. I worry the most about those that, one, are unable to access the healthcare system or don't have access to good quality of care, and two, those that are more financially dependent on physical exertion for their jobs. So for me, I sit at home all day and I can, you know, lay down whenever I need to, essentially. Right. But if I had a job where I was on my feet, I absolutely would not be able to keep my job. And so I think that the disparities based on the type of work that you do, as well as racial and ethnic identity, are very crucial and also understudied. I think as we come up with the different treatments, we will need to make a real effort to make sure that we are both diagnosing and treating all who are affected by the disease. And the physician education piece will be a really important component of that.
Near the end of your review article, you speak to several topics which resonate certainly with me and the work we do at the American Lung Association. Aside from more funding of research, two other arms of our mission are achieved through education and advocacy. Can you give us your thoughts on both professional and lay public education needs to be done in this topic, as well as, and importantly, at the legislative level that can help some of the problems we're dealing with?
Absolutely. To start with the general public, I think there's still, as we talked about a little bit before, a major lack of awareness of the risk of long COVID. We're seeing people now who thought COVID was a cold, they ended up with long COVID, and they feel like they've been lied to by the public health communication that they've received, because it's been saying, oh, if you're vaccinated, you're going to be fine. And they're ending up with these debilitating effects. And so I think, although it's an inconvenient narrative, we need to do more to educate the general public about the severity of long COVID and the fact that about 1 in 10 people that get COVID end up with it. I mean, that's a major risk. The other thing that sort of ties into the advocacy piece is a lot of people who have long COVID actually don't want to share it with those around them. And it's kind of, it's a taboo topic to say, I'm really tired, I can't get out of bed. It's very easy for people to minimize. And so often folks keep it to themselves. And that feeds into the narrative of many different people saying, oh, well, I don't know anyone with long COVID, so it can't be that common. But actually it is. It's just that your loved one or your friend isn't telling you because they don't feel comfortable doing so. So that feeds into the advocacy. That's part of why I speak up about it so much, because I feel like the more voices we have saying, hey, this is affecting me, this is a real problem, the more hopefully progress we can make. So taking the physician education piece next, it's absolutely crucial that physicians are educated on the ongoing literature. And, you know, it's changing so fast that I understand it's crucial. I hope that there are, you know, succinct continuing education pieces that can be made for physicians so that it can kind of fit into their normal workflow and their normal upkeep with the literature to be able to get them the information that they need to recognize it in their patients and provide the treatment that they need. And then legislatively, you know, again, I think the challenge is it's inconvenient for the political narrative that long COVID continues, but we really need much more funding for long COVID research, in particular clinical trials. You know, the RECOVER program is great. It's a great start, but I think it's going to be insufficient for what we need, particularly on the clinical trials front, given what I've seen so far. And then the other piece that has been really challenging is the disability coverage piece. So many people are having their claims denied, even though they're extremely debilitated. And the process to get the claims approved is so long and so arduous for someone with an energy limiting disease. It is almost an insurmountable barrier. And so we're just not getting the support that we need now while we wait for those clinical trials in 5 years to be able to treat right. our disease. And to me, it's an emergency, basically. It's a public health emergency. One other point I'll say that feeds into that is that the level of disability overall in the United States just reached an all-time high. And we believe that that's because so many folks with long COVID are putting in disability claims and are becoming disabled. That's part of the reason that I think this is such an emergency.
Oh, excellent point. Well, you have shared such an in-depth discussion of this topic, both from your professional expertise and also from your personal experience, which is really important for listeners to understand. You know, the symptoms and many of these patients are going to go on because the pandemic, although we think it may be calming down, we know it's going to be with us going forward. COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2 are going to be here. Are there any other additional closing remarks you would like to make at this time? You really covered things very well.
Yeah, I'll take sort of the appeal on the personal level to anyone listening, which is, first of all, if you end up getting COVID, I encourage you to get a PCR test to document the results just in case you ever get long COVID, so that you have the information in your medical record that you need to be able to access care as best you can. And then second of all, if you know someone with long COVID or you find out that you know someone with long COVID, to do what you can to support them. You know, we talked about how the societal support and the medical support really isn't there. And a lot of loved ones unintentionally end up minimizing the condition. And so things you can do to support them are, one, ask them what they need and how you can support them. It could be something as simple as dropping off meals or listening to them, you know, talk about how challenging things are. And two, educate yourself about what they're experiencing so that they don't have to take on the burden of explaining it to you and you can better support them. I think those are the main points.
Great message to end on. And again, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. Great
to meet you. Thanks again to Dr. Moore Vogel for joining us today. COVID-19 research and development has been a hallmark topic for Lungcast since we launched 3 years ago this month. You can reflect on all the progress that's been made by listening to our very first shows featuring Dr. David Ho, thoracic surgeon Dr. Ankit Bharat, and former NIAID director Dr. Anthony Fauci. Be sure to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.